We're back on Wooden Sticks. I'm Kevin Gork, the host of the show. Really excited about another Minnesota tie-in to hockey greatness today. You know, I'm obsessed with playoff hockey and the Wild this year, as we've talked about a couple different times here on the show recently, aren't a part of the playoffs for the first time in a long time. And so you get into that situation where there's some disappointment, and then you try to identify with teams that you have a connection to. And for me, it's always about whether it's coaches or players that I've come in contact with or worked with or have a relationship with. So even though I'm not a big Boston Bruins fan, I'm cheering for Boston. I love Charlie Coyle. He's one of my all-time favorite members of the Minnesota Wild that I got to cover. And I got to know Charlie when he first came into the league, and we still stay in contact. And he's just one of the nicest human beings I've ever had the chance to work with. The Dallas Stars. I never cheer for the Dallas Stars, but it's hard for me not to pull for Jake Oettinger. He went to high school at Lakeville North with my daughter, Maddie, my middle daughter. They were classmates and took the team on a really cool run, I think all the way to the state championship in one of his 3 years at Lakeville North. So that's a cool connection. Brock Besser at Vancouver, a Burnsville guy that I've known since he was a sophomore in high school. Another terrific human being, another guy that you have to pull for. So the Stanley Cup playoffs for me always take on kind of a different feel. Today I get to have a conversation with a guy that back in 2006 I was cheering for. That particular year, it ended up being Edmonton and Carolina in the finals. And Carolina had Brett Hedekin, who we're going to talk to today, who played locally at North St. Paul, on to St. Cloud State, had a brilliant NHL career. And he also had Matt Cullen on that team. And Matt Cullen was a guy that when I was the boys coach at Burnsville in the early 1990s, he was the star player on the Moorhead Spuds. And back then there was a holiday tournament at the old St. Paul Civic Center, and our Burnsville team got to compete against Matt Cullen's Moorhead Spuds. His dad was the head coach. So I've got great memories and covering Matt with the Wild, a lot like the aforementioned Charlie Coyle, just a terrific, terrific human. So to see Carolina win the Cup in 2006 was extra special for me. And seeing Brett Hedekin and Matt Cullen, two local guys on that big stage, they both played such a big role in that hockey team. And I've gotten the chance to really get to know Brett Hedekin over the years because we're both in broadcasting. I just wrapped up my 18th year covering the Minnesota Wild. He covers the San Jose Sharks. And he's one of those guys that not only is he terrific at the craft, he's an excellent broadcaster, but he takes the time to have the conversation with all of us that cover the Minnesota Wild. So if you get to the mess hall before a game, you know, both pockets in that dining hall are preparing to broadcast the game that night. So we'll all sit on one side and our producer and director will stop in, and you know, whether it's LaPanta who does play-by-play or some of the people that rotate through the booth like Carter and Wes Walls will come through, and then the pregame crew will be there with Mark Parrish, and you know, usually it's Audra Martin hosting the Wild Live production. We'll all have a conversation about what we're going to try to bring out in both the pre and post game shows, but also the game broadcast. Well, Brett takes the time to come over and make the connection, find out what's going on kind of behind the scenes with the Minnesota Wild. And yeah, he watches from afar. He's a Minnesota guy, but he likes to really get the details of the matchup. And so he's awesome at what he does. And it doesn't surprise me the career that he had spanning over a thousand regular season games, being to multiple Stanley Cup finals. I mean, he's just that guy, right? He's just always, whatever he's done it at a really high level, and he's just a class act. So I'm super excited about the conversation today. And you know, it's a long way from Polar Arena in North St. Paul to the top of the mountain hoisting Lord Stanley's Cup. That's a long, long journey. It's one thing to play locally at a place like Edina, or back in the day when Mark Parrish played at Bloomington Jefferson and Ben Clymer also played for the Baby Blue. You know, North St. Paul has never been a big hockey power, at least in my memory. And to be the type of player that can play multiple sports there at a high level, go on to play Division I hockey at St. Cloud State, represent your country multiple times in the Olympics. I mean, Brett Hedekin has done it all, man. This guy is a tremendous, tremendous talent. And I can't wait to hear some of the stories. And today we're going to get a chance to kind of go behind the scenes and find out what it's all about when you're sitting in that locker room and it's game seven and knowing that you had your heart broke years earlier in a similar situation, game seven, playing for, at that time, the Vancouver Canucks at Madison Square Garden against the New York Rangers. Now you're back there. You're at home. You're playing Edmonton. You're Brett Hedekin. You're at the back end of your career. This is a chance of a lifetime. What's it like to be sitting in that locker room? We're going to get his perspective on all of it. We know the story has a happy ending, and I can't wait to hear all the stories around that terrific run for Brett Hedekin and the Carolina Hurricanes. We'll have a great conversation here. And don't forget, you can be a more than just a listener. You can be a part of the show. We can promote whatever business you're a part of. Maybe you've got a friend or a family member that needs a boost up. We've got you covered here. Karen Cleary can get the job done. K Cleary at talknorth.com if you want to be a part of the show. We've got some great sponsors, including my friends at Beta Bay Boat Club. Guys, summer is actually here. I got out in the water this past weekend. It was beautiful on Lake Minnetonka, and the boat club makes it so easy. You literally show up, park your car, check in, and within 3 or 4 minutes, you're out on the water. And the beauty of it is you're out there for a few hours. You're soaking up some sun. Maybe you bring some food out there, some cold beverages. It's like going to the cabin without leaving the Twin Cities. And then you get done, you hop off the boat, and within 2 or 3 minutes, you're in your car on your way to wherever your next destination would be. It's the Country Club boating experience. And guess what? There are memberships available now at Beta Bay Boat Club. Call 952-401-3880 or find them at betabayboatclub.com. Now, when people think of Freemasons, they often think of the secret handshakes and unusual hats. And of course, they think of those pancake breakfasts. Minnesota Masonic Charities would prefer that you think about the work that they do right here in our community. Places like the Masonic Cancer Center at the University of Minnesota or the Masonic Children's Hospital. And of course, the Masonic Home over in Bloomington. They are just a few examples of the important work that Freemasons support in Minnesota. As part of the largest fraternal organization in the world, Masons have consistently answered the call when it comes to charitable needs. I'm happy that Minnesota Masonic Charities has chosen our show here as a place to help spread the word. And I can't wait in the coming weeks to learn more about all the wonderful things Minnesota Masonic Charities are involved in. When we come back here on Wooden Sticks, North St. Paul's own Brett Hedekin. Back on Wooden Sticks, and really excited to introduce our special guest this week. Hails from North St. Paul, played college hockey at St. Cloud State, had an amazing NHL career that featured two different runs to the Stanley Cup, one ending in victory in 2006. He's now broadcasting out for NBC Sports California with the San Jose Sharks, a dear friend of mine in the broadcasting world, and it is Brett Hedekin. And Brett, thanks for being here.
Yeah, Kevin, thanks so much for having me on. Hey, just I don't want to correct you already, but it's actually three Stanley Cup runs that I had. I was fortunate to be a part of three runs, which is pretty amazing. But
which one am I missing? I've got the Vancouver one.
Yeah, then I had the 2002 one. Kind of slides under the radar, where it was before the salary cap era, where you know, $130 million Detroit Red Wings. And you go back to look at that roster, the 2002 team, and you won't even believe it. But the Carolina Hurricanes team went all the way to the Cup Final that year, and we lost to Detroit. We won game one. They won game two. And then if you ever had a chance to watch game three, it was pretty epic. We were up 1-0 with 50 seconds, I think, to go in the game, where Lidstrom shot the puck, hit, you know, 5 feet wide of the left side of the net, hit Brett Hull's stick, goes dead right sideways, scores from an odd angle to tie the game, and goes into triple overtime, I believe. And Igor Larionov, 41 years old, I think at the time, scored the goal in overtime. And one of the longest games in NHL history. But we had them on the ropes. Had we won game three, we would have been up 2-1 coming back for game four in our building to go up potentially 3-1 to then have to go back to Detroit. But they won that game, and then they went on to win the next two. But it was a quiet, under-the-radar, better series than it came out. But that was kind of the beginning of me staying in Carolina that led to the 2006. But sorry to get into that right away, but it was a fun run.
No, I think it's fantastic. And I that's where I kind of wanted to start, because I'm fascinated with playoff hockey. And like you, our teams are on the sidelines that we cover this year. So I'm kind of living vicariously through connections that I have in the league, players that I've covered and coaches that I know. And what are these players feeling right now? I think about how long the season is. You guys gather in September, start the season in October. So we're 8 months into a season, 82 regular season games. The first round is in the books. Now we're in the second round. put us in the locker room, Brett. What are these guys dealing with? Because we know in the NHL what a grind the season is. And in the playoffs, everybody talks about playing through pain. What are these guys dealing with right now?
Well, definitely, you know, through round one, and I think the whole league and the NHL is kind of looking at that round one thinking, wow, it's a little bit of a disappointment. And I kind of agree. I thought it could have been a little bit more, I guess, angry is a better word for usually round one, where it gets a lot of hate, because both teams, when they come into that round one, still think they have the potential to win a cup. And so there's a lot on the line to get out of round one. And sometimes that round one is a lot. Now we're seeing this round two kind of amp up a little bit, and I'm liking some of the games already, but you're starting to feel, you know, the everyday or every other day routine where you play the game and it's going to be a lot of ebbs and flows to the night. You might come out on top, you might lose the game. And now the next day is about recovery. It's about the rest. It's about the nutrition, and really kind of letting the mind, I feel, rest. Because once you wake up in that morning on a game day, when you get into this rhythm of a Stanley Cup run, it's almost like the light switch comes on right when that alarm goes off in the morning. And that light switch basically turns you on to know that today is a game day. And everything you do is moving towards that 7:05 or 7:35, whatever time that puck drop is, that you have to have all your faculties ready to roll at its optimum, at you know, your legs, your mind, and everything is ready to roll to really regroup. No matter if you lost 6-1 the night before or you won 6-1, you have to start fresh and you have to treat every game like a new, you know, kind of blank canvas.
Yeah, and just the emotion involved. Like I watched, we're recording this on a Wednesday. The two games that we watched last night were overtime games, and just the ebb and flow of emotions and the back and forth. I think of what Dallas had in that 3-0 lead against a Colorado team that looked, frankly, very rusty and uninterested early. But with Colorado, you can never count that team out. And then the emotion that Carolina's dealing with, your team that you played for, like they looked like the favorite coming in. They get punched in the mouth in game one. They play well enough to win last night, but Shesterkin is so good for the Rangers and they just couldn't figure him out.
I agree. I thought the Carolina played about as good a game as you could possibly play. I think, you know, the calls may have favored, and the officiating has been fine. I just think, you know, a couple breaks went the New York Rangers way, I think, at optimal times. But now you're down 2-0, having to go back to Carolina. I've been down 2-0 in a series before. I've been down 3-1 in a series and come back to win a series. So I've been through all of those sorts of circumstances, and it's really about the group. It's about the group you have inside that locker room that I think when you know, like if you just started the conversation and how it's been 8 months and you have a bunch of guys that even at before training camp came into training camp ready to work. And then you get in through training camp and you have a season and you go through the ups and downs of an 82 game season. There's a lot of days in there where guys could have mailed it in, and probably the teams that don't make it this far are the ones that the guys just mail it in. They mail in a practice, they mail in a game. But these teams that start to separate themselves are the ones that don't mail it in on game 45, you know, in a middle of you're in Winnipeg having to practice and whether or not you're going to punch in or not, or you're in Florida and you've got to put in a practice and you don't want to be there. Right. But those are the teams that really get to the next level, that the work has been done when you're down 2-0 and you're down 3-1 in a series, where you go into that next game and you're calm. And you're ready to go at it again because you know you've got the right crew to step into that game and step in the middle of the ring, not on the ropes, but step, walk out in the middle of the ring, go toe to toe with whoever you're going with. And I think that's what separates teams right now when you're down 3-1 or down 2-0 in Carolina's case.
That's awesome. I love hearing that. And I love the stories of, you know, believing you can come back because you've done it before. We're going to dive into all those cool playoff games you've played in, but I want to go back to where it all started. I want to go back to North St. Paul. And I know from doing a little bit of research that you played a bunch of sports, and this doesn't surprise me. We've always known what a great athlete you are. I did not realize you played both football and soccer. I'm not surprised you grew up playing some golf, because hockey players with golf, it's kind of synonymous with the leg strength involved. How valuable, Brett, was the background you took to the rink every day, knowing that you weren't just a hockey player, you played multiple sports?
I think it's so important. So many athletes today, they want to get really singular focused on one sport. And you know, realistically, it's not good for the body. And the older I got, the more I realized that that was really important to balance the body with running, with, you know, skating, with doing maybe some, you know, golfing, where your body's, your upper body's moving, your eye hand coordination, has got to be there. I just really love the fact too, of every season you put the gear away, you know, that hockey season ended. It was nice to kind of put it in the bag and then throw it in the closet. And then now it was baseball season, or it was, you know, come the fall, you're playing football. And then when football ended, you knew, like, that last game of football, it was like, oh man, I can't wait to get my hockey gear out. Right. It's, you had that itch to get in the arena and the kind of the excitement to get back into, to playing hockey again. So I think not only physically and the body, what it needs to be able to do other sports, and to completely become a full rounded, well-rounded athlete, but then also just to kind of have a fresh mind going into the new season, because you've just played another sport for the last, you know, 3 months or whatever it was. So, I think it's integral into kids' development, mentally, physically, to be able to play multiple sports. And again, you become an athlete, not just a hockey player.
And when you start playing sports in high school, you're doing it for the fun of the game. You're loving it up. You're playing with your buddies. At what point, Brett, did you realize that if you were going to be a Division I athlete, if you were going to have a chance to down the road be a pro athlete, that hockey would likely be the sport where that would land?
Man, it's kind of a tough question, because I think at 10 years old, you know, the people that are our age, will remember this moment when the 1980 Olympic team, and people that have seen the show Miracle. I mean, I just watched it, I think, during the Christmas time with my daughters, and I sat down and I started telling them stories about Herb Brooks and, you know, why he's so important in my life and, you know, what happened in 1980. And they watched the show for the first time. They had never seen it. And here I'm crying over there on my little recliner chair, and I'm wiping the tears because I get so emotional every time I watch it. But at 10, I remember sitting on the carpet, leaned up against the couch with my dad, watching the 1980 Olympic team beat the Russians, and then sitting down in almost that same spot and then seeing them win the gold, and me saying to myself that that's what I want to do. I want to become an Olympian someday. And so I think at 10, I started that journey, and I knew I didn't want to always stay in North St. Paul. Nothing against my little nice warm hometown there of North St. Paul, but I knew I wanted to go play hockey somewhere, and particularly college. And the only way I was going to do that is if I worked hard and trained. And so I started training at a young age, started going to the weight room and started getting stronger, and knowing that this is the only way I was going to have a shot. But to be honest with you, Kevin, I don't think I really knew I'd have that shot, even after doing all the work in the weight room, all those young years, until really my senior year, when things just, I grew the year before 7 inches in a year. And then my senior year, I became a 6'2" now all of a sudden, and this kid that could skate. And now I had a couple of colleges looking at me. And so that's when it really began, is really my senior year of high school.
And you've got multiple ties to Herb Brooks. We're going to get into the 1992 Winter Olympics, but I think of St. Cloud State around that time and the impact that Herb Brooks had on not only that institution, but college hockey in Minnesota, as we still know it now, with St. Thomas being added to the mix as the most recent local school to go to Division I hockey. This was Herb Brooks' vision 40 years ago. How did you end up at St. Cloud State?
Well, only one school came knocking to offer me a partial scholarship, and it was St. Cloud. Doug Woog really knew who I was, and I went to all of Doug Woog's camps as a kid growing up in the summer. I would just have some summer camps once in a while that would last about a week, and my parents would sign me up, and I'd do this Doug Woog camp. And I got to know Doug over the years, and he always saw my development, saw me getting better. And after my senior year, he called me and said, "Hey, we really love to have you play for the Vulcans. We've given our scholarships up, but we really like you. We, you know, if you play for the Vulcans next year, we'll take a look at you for one of the scholarships." And then I really, really wanted to go to Duluth because I had some family members that lived up near Duluth. And Dave Sertich, once he heard that St. Cloud called me, he called me on the phone and said, "Hey, Brett, Mr. Sertich here. I'm just letting you know that I heard you got a scholarship offer from St. Cloud." I said, "Yeah, it was really, they called me the other day and offered me a scholarship." He goes, "Well, I just want to wish you the best of luck and good, you know, take care." That was pretty much all I got from Duluth. And so St. Cloud, knocked on my door and gave me a partial scholarship, and I took it. And with the hopes of going to St. Cloud, again, built off of Herb Brooks' idea of giving more kids an opportunity in Minnesota to play Division I hockey. And because of that, I was one of the initial guys from St. Cloud when we went from an independent school of Division III to moving to Division I. And then the year I got there, we were independent my freshman year. And then by the sophomore year, we were in the WCHA. So that was just a huge moment for me in my career, getting that opportunity.
And you mentioned the WCHA, and a lot of us as older hockey fans, and I'm a few years older than you are, remember what an unbelievable conference the WCHA at that time was building towards. It became the premier conference in Division I hockey, specifically on the Western side. I mean, you could make a case for some of the conferences out East, but we know how good that conference was. And how much did that help your development competing against the very best every weekend?
Oh, it was huge. I think that freshman year, they brought in 10 freshmen. Three were Canadian defensemen, and I was a defenseman my whole life. And so, Brett, they said, we don't really need you as a defenseman. We need you as a forward. So I, first time in my life I ever played forward, they moved me to forward my freshman year. I didn't have a clue at what I was doing. But it was an opportunity. It was an opportunity to practice on a daily basis. We trained every day. We ate together. It was one of those moments. I was so excited to be a college hockey athlete. And even though, you know, there was moments during that freshman year, and I was, you know, if I ever do any motivational speaking for kids, I tell them the story because it's so impactful. I mean, that freshman year I was in and out of the lineup, and the nights I didn't play for the Huskies in a game at the old arena, not even where the Herb Brooks Center is now in St. Cloud. We used to play at the old one, you know, about 30 minutes out of campus. And I would be hitting the play button on the cassette player to play music on the intercom during the stoppages of play my freshman year. Yeah. I mean, and I didn't quit believing in myself. I knew I could have an opportunity. And, you know, after my freshman year, I walked into the coach's office and said, "Coach Dahl, I know I can play defense. I know I can help this team on defense if you just give me a shot." And he basically said, "Yeah, go back and play defense in the summer. And we'll see you back here next year as a defenseman and see how it goes." And, you know, years later, I talked to Coach Dahl about that. He basically said, "Yeah, I thought I was going to cut you, to be honest with you." But I came back and made the team. And, you know, I guess that's kind of where it all began.
Well, the rest is history. And a couple years later, after watching the 1980 Miracle on Ice, in 1992, you're a part of Team USA. Herb Brooks is involved. It's Albertville, France. You're going to end up meeting, you don't know it at the time, but you're going to end up meeting your wife, Christy Yamaguchi. This is a pretty impactful moment in your life, not just your hockey life, but your world. Back to those emotions and how that process took place, and take us to the Olympics. What was it like?
Yeah, so after my junior year where, you know, so think of sophomore year, I finally played defense. And then my junior year, it just kind of exploded. Everything I shot was going in the net, and I was, you know, putting up points, and it just was one of those magical years. And I remember being on spring break with, you know, all my teammates, and one of my buddies that played on our team, Fred Knipscher, his girlfriend at the time, their family had a place in Florida. I'm down there in Florida with all my other buddies and teammates, and the phone rings, and it's my parents. And they called and they said, "Hey, Brett, we just got a call from the U.S. national team. They want you to fly home tomorrow, get your gear, meet the team in Boston, and fly to Russia to represent the United States of America and play in this tournament, I guess, called the Pravda Cup." And so my mom and dad on the call, I mean, I'll never forget that call as well. I mean, they were crying. I was emotional because I had never, ever been asked to play on a U.S. national team ever. Not when I was younger to, you know, the World Juniors or any of that kind of stuff. And so I was kind of off the radar until that moment when they called me after my junior year. And I went over to Russia. I played four of the best games of my life. Dave Peterson was the coach over there in Russia, and he was going to be the coach of the 92 Olympic team. And they asked me to try out for the national team and the Olympic team that next summer. And I made the national team, not knowing if I'd even make it to the Olympic Games. So all of us leave school our senior years, or sometimes if you were younger or even beyond that, you had to completely shut everything down and you joined the national team. We traveled around the world. And then right before the Olympic Games, I guess, I don't know, 15, 20 days before the Olympic Games, they basically tell you you're either going home to New York or you're going to Albertville, France to represent the United States. And I happened to be on that list to be on, you know, go to the Olympic Games in 1992, my first Olympic Games. And really going from that 10-year-old as a dream to then seeing my name on that list to say, hey, you're going to be on the team was pretty, I guess it was surreal.
Well, do you ever pinch yourself? Because I think of serendipity and fate and all those things that are tied to this specific experience for you. You were meant to be there. And I know it's cliche. And I know Herb Brooks talks about it in that famous speech before the game against the Russians in 1980. But literally, Brett, you were meant to be there. And I mean, looking back, it's got to make you not just smile, but almost like think, what if I wasn't there?
Yeah, I think the one thing I could recommend, you know, for kids listening out there, or even people, I think being positive, staying positive is one thing that you need to continue to do, because when you're positive and that chance arises, it presents itself, right? It's an opportunity that's right there for you. And if you've stayed positive and you kept believing in yourself, when that opportunity presents itself, you're ready to jump into the door and run through it. And I think that was the one thing I really feel back in those moments where there was an opportunity in front of me and I knew it. And I knew this was my chance, particularly the Russia, you know, going over there for the Pravda Cup and playing in those four games. And then, you know, training, getting ready for the tryouts and knowing that this was my next opportunity and running through that door. And I think you're right. It was meant to be for me to be there, but it's also a situation where I think I was always, I guess, just smart enough to know that this was a chance of a lifetime that I knew I had to take advantage of. And I was fortunate to always kind of really keep believing in myself to be able to run through that. Now, it wasn't always that way. I mean, there were moments I had some self-doubt along the way. Believe me, a lot of those days during my professional career and even during that national team year, it was a lot of tough, tough moments. But to get me to that moment was you know, meant to be. And I agree, Kevin.
What was Albertville like? What, you know, the living quarters, the games, the rank, what was the experience like?
Man, I wish I could go back and watch all of those games again. It would be really weird seeing myself at that age, you know, and I would probably be cringing at some of the things the decisions I made in the game. But I think, you know, you're just flying by the seat of your pants. You're absorbing it all in. I think I can really remember that moment where you get all of the gear of the United States, you know, the swag. Yes. Your opening ceremonies, the closing ceremonies gear, to your everyday back and forth to the rink gear. And I just remember that was that moment where it really, I did pinch myself. I was like, holy cow, this is real. I'm actually here. That was the moment it all kind of hit me in the face. But the games really were a blur, but I thought we played terrific. I think the best finish since the 1980 Olympic team really is our 1992 team. We took fourth. I'll never forget the Russia crossover game where we win that game. We guarantee ourselves a silver medal and, you know, 2-2 with 10 minutes to go in the game. And I believe there was a couple penalties called against us at the same time. It was a 5-on-3 situation. They scored a couple goals and the game was really over. I think we came back the next day and had to play the Czechs for the bronze. I think we were just flat. I think we were tired and they were rested and they spanked us, I think 5-1. And, you know, just like that, the Olympic Games is over and we didn't have a medal, but I'm real proud of that group and the way we performed. All of us were amateurs. You know, all of us were pretty much kids, you know, 18 to 21 years old. You know, there's a few older guys on there too, but for the most part, real young group.
And then how did you meet your current wife, Christy, at the Olympics?
Well, that was opening ceremonies. You know, we met at opening ceremonies. Just she took a photo with all of us hockey players. She was a real big hockey fan. She still is today, loves the San Jose Sharks, who I work for now. And she's had season tickets for almost since day one. And so she came over, took a photo, and then our lives crossed paths several years later when I was playing for the Canucks, reintroduced myself to her. And that's kind of how that whole story took place. But we've got two beautiful daughters, Kira and Emma, and it's been really fun to see them just live their own lives now and us to get, you know, be able to sit back and just enjoy them turning into really, really neat people, which has been fun to see.
I just love that you had a chance to sit down and take in Miracle, the movie, with them for their first time. That's a special dad night right there.
It was, you know, they never knew the stories of Herb Brooks and the things that he did for not only my career, you know, I've got a really interesting story about Herb where, you know, I was really kind of upset because he called me in 2001. It was after the season. And he said, Brett, he literally called me on the phone and said, Brett, I really want you to go over to play in the world championships. And I want you and Phil Housley and LeChance and all these other guys that were kind of that potential, the 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of the next 2002 Olympic Games in Salt Lake. And so he goes, I want to see you guys all play and perform over on that big sheet. And I want to make sure that I can pick the guys that are going to, you know, potentially be on that team. And so I said, hell yeah, Herb, I'll go over there and play for you. And so I went over there and again, one of those opportunities I knew, I really wanted to make another Olympic team on that 02 team. And I played really the tournament of my life to that point. I mean, it was a heck of a tournament for me. I ended up getting this watch for the defenseman of the USA team at the end, which was really nice from the tournament to give me that. And then, come that next training camp for the Olympic team in Colorado Springs, I was not even an afterthought. I was like on the C group, didn't even get a chance. They go on, they select their team. I'm not on it. The guys that I outplayed in the Germany at the World Championships that were ahead of me. And I was kind of bummed out that Herb, you know, kind of didn't live up to his word, you know, taking a look at us. And I was pissed. You know, that was one of those moments where you're just like, you know, that wasn't cool. And it's particularly a St. Paul guy where Herb is and me, a North St. Paul guy, I was really bummed out. Well, that first story I told you, Kevin, about the 2002 Stanley Cup final team, that game 3, the one that went into triple overtime that we lost. Well, at 4 o'clock that afternoon, when I got up from my nap, the phone rang and it was Herb Brooks. And I answered it. I said, hello, is Brett there? This is Brett. Hey, Brett, this is Herb Brooks. And I basically said, yeah, you know, bleep, bleep, right? Who is this? I thought it was somebody playing a joke on me. He goes, no, this is Herb. And I said, hey, Herb. And he basically just said, you know, Brett, you're playing great hockey and I really want to see you win that Stanley Cup and bring it back home to St. Paul for us. And that was just one of those moments where, you know, I appreciated his call. And it was a moment where I think that was his way of just, you know, maybe having it out in a nice way of just saying, hey, you know, I didn't give you a chance and hey, look at you now, you're playing good and whatever that looked like for him. But I appreciate it. I think he passed away that summer or the next. That was my last conversation I ever had with Herb. But, you know, he did do a lot for me and my career and given me an opportunity at St. Cloud. I never would have, who knows where I would have ended up had I not had that chance with St. Cloud that he really presented for a lot of Minnesota kids.
And you had both those cup runs. You mentioned the one that I did not bring up, but I also have to focus a little bit on 1994. You guys had that run all the way to the finals against the New York Rangers. Those two cup runs set you up for maybe the third time being the charm. And I'm fascinated by the 2006, the entire playoffs, because there were some crazy upsets. Edmonton ends up in the cup as the last team in on one side of the conference. You guys end up having to go 7 games in your conference final against Buffalo. How much of those first two cup runs, you know, now you're a leader, right? Now you're one of the go-to guys on this Carolina team. So people are looking to you, and you guys had a great season. You had 112 points. I think Ottawa had one more point than you at 113. So this was no surprise that you guys might have some success. But now as a leader and having been through this before, how much did that help you?
Oh, it was huge. Yeah, Kevin, it was you know, I think after the 94 team, I kind of always had to drive myself to kind of figure out how am I going to get back to that situation again. And then after the 2002 run, it was really the 2004 Stanley Cup team from Tampa Bay that won the Stanley Cup. And Ben Clymer, the local guy that you guys get a chance to work with so much, he had a Stanley Cup party. And a lot of times people say, hey, stay away from the cup. Don't get near it. Well, I said, no, I'm done being superstitious around the cup because it hadn't worked yet. Right. So I'm like, no, I'm coming to your party, Ben. And I went to his party and I sat there around that cup as long as I possibly could, staring at the names, looking at the engravings, seeing the incredible history to that Stanley Cup. I mean, for a guy that's never won it, any Minnesotan that has listening to this now or people that are hockey players, go spend some time, find that Stanley Cup, go to the Hockey Hall of Fame and be able to sit close to that thing and feel it. Because if that doesn't motivate you on how, on where you want to put your purpose and your training, and every lift and every rep that you do doesn't drive towards that Stanley Cup, then what are you doing? Ask yourself, why are you playing the game of hockey at this level, at the NHL level, if your goal isn't to win the Stanley Cup? And I think leaning on those two previous Stanley Cup losses, particularly the 94 and the 2002 run, they were so similar in a lot of ways, but yet, you know, different environments, you know, being in Canada, that was amazing. You know, going against the New York Rangers, it was one country against another. It was one of the greatest runs I've ever been a part of. And then, you know, the 02 run really taught me really how to become a better grinder, how to become a little bit more mean, which I needed to learn. That's what I learned in really that 2002 run. And then really putting, you know, the emotion, the ability to calm my breathing down, all of the mental reps I did for years. I mean, I spent 10 years doing sports psychology and really helping myself be ready for that next moment. And so, yeah, the 2006 really leaned on those experiences. It also leaned on just the ability to be able to calm myself. And that 2004 Cup party repurposed me to know that this is why I play the game. And really that got me ready for that 2006 Stanley Cup run. And man, it was really fun to be with that team and that group of men that allowed us to go all the way.
Okay. So every kid, when they play street hockey, at some point they're out there saying, okay, it's game seven of the Stanley Cup. Now you lived that in 94 on the wrong end of it against the New York Rangers. So put us in the locker room. It's game seven in 2006. You've been close twice. You've been to a game seven in a Stanley Cup and gone all the way to the top of the mountain and not finished the deal. What are your emotions like personally as you sit in that locker before game seven?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I can really even picture that whole day. You know, it's funny. I can hardly remember games I've played in, like even big games like that. I can remember just certain clips and moments of it. And I wish I should go back and watch that whole series again. I'd scratch my head and can't believe on some of the things that both teams did, I think, to each other. But that wouldn't happen really in today's game, although it's gotten better. No doubt about it. I mean, even that 2006, they changed the rules and got better. My point is like, you remember earlier I talked about how the work had been done at the beginning of the year, midway through the year. I mean, we were having practices, Kevin, like I'd never seen. In all of the years I played the game, I'd never seen a team practice as hard as that 2006 Stanley Cup team in Carolina. It's like one guy was driving and pushing the next, and the next guy was trying to outdo the other guy. And when you got 25, you know, 28 of those types of guys, and everybody feels like they let their ego and they check that at the door. And I will say that Peter Laviolette did a really good job that season, knowing that he didn't have to poke and prod a bunch of guys to have them work harder. What he needed to do and what he figured out is that he had a bunch of thoroughbreds that now he just got to get them he just had to find a way to allow them to work together and to believe in one another and to know that every guy was important. And he did some team building at the start of the year that I felt was the differentiator between maybe a winning team and a losing team is that he pulled us together so early that the work had been done throughout the course of that year with every guy feeling important in the practices. And then sure enough, there we are in that morning of that Stanley Cup Finals game seven on home ice. And we have an opportunity to close it out. And it was so calm in there, Kevin. I can just remember guys at really at ease, and nobody was panicked. Everybody was just like a machine, like clocked in. Every guy putting their skates on. I remember looking around that locker room and just looking at every guy, knowing I wouldn't want to be in a war with anybody else but them. And I think they probably looked around and said the same thing about everybody else. And when you got that confidence and knowing that the work has been done, that you didn't have to cram for the test, right? It wasn't one of those things where 2 weeks before, you know, the final, all of a sudden, or even a day before the final, you all of a sudden decided to study. No. The studying was done. You were prepared. And now it was just a matter of going out and executing. That's exactly what we did. From the drop of the puck, there was no doubt we were coming out of that game on top. There's just zero doubt in my mind. And, you know, we executed We ended up getting the empty netter to ice the game 3-1, and you know, we become champions. But I think I look back, it's more about those moments of training. It's moments of believing in one another. It's the moments of training, you know, the practice training sessions that you had that were so unbelievable that really made the difference.
And I get chills every time I see the commercials on TV. I think the latest one, at least in the last calendar year, was this Kiss Me song by Sixpence None the Richer. And they show the guys holding the cup, kissing the cup, and you just get chills, right? So for you, that moment when you finally are handed the cup, Brett, and you get to lift it up and skate around a little bit, take us back to that moment. And then were you able to like see a family member or two that was on the ice, or connect with somebody in that building, or maybe it was a teammate, as you got to skate around the ice for the first time as a Stanley Cup champion?
Wow. Yeah. You know, there's a picture of the whole team kind of arm in arm as Gary Bettman handed the picture, or the picture that it looked like a picture that's worth a million, you know, bucks or more words or whatever you want to say, when Bettman handed it over to Roddy Brind'Amour, and all of us guys are looking at our captain, and we all know the work ethic that he put in on a daily basis. There wasn't one guy that was like, hey, that should be me. It was like every guy arm in arm was like, absolutely, brother, raise that thing. And it was just one of the greatest, I think one of the top, I mean, Ray Bourque's lift was pretty amazing when Sakic just basically walked it over to him and gave him the cup. That was pretty cool. But when Roddy Brind'Amour, his celebration, you know, when he picked up that cup, man, it was one of the coolest things I've seen. And then he gave it to Glenn Wesley, you know, 20 years in the NHL, never won a Stanley Cup. And Glenn Wesley just texted me the other day. He goes, Hedy, I was just watching the video of the cup final, game 7, and us getting the cup and me getting it from Roddy, and then me handing it to you. And that moment when Glenn yells my name, and I just couldn't believe it. And I come over and he handed it to me. And it really, it was one of those moments too, just prior to that, when the goalie was pulled and it was 6-on-5, and Roddy, you know, Eric Staal, everybody knows him from the Minnesota Wild days, Justin Williams, they call him Mr. Game 7, and then me and Mike Commodore on the ice to ice the game with 50 seconds to go with the empty net. And the puck comes down that right side. Pronger's trying to get it by me on the left defense, you know, corner. I knock it out of the air. I get it to Staal. Staal puts it on William Stick, who splits the defense, and he goes down and ices it into the empty net. And I remember coming back to the bench after we all jumped on each other in the corner in that place, the building, the roof came off of it. And Glenn Wesley is over on the bench, and I'm hugging him, and he's crying. The tears are flowing down his cheeks. And so, you know, when Glenn turned to me, he goes, Hedy, we did it, man. We did it. And, you know, he handed me the cup after he got it from Roddy. And I think the one thing that came to my head, Kevin, was holy cow. I was right to not give up. I was right to keep believing in myself. I was right to, you know, keep leaning into others, keep learning from others, not thinking I had, you know it all. You got to keep trying to get better on a daily basis. I'm so thankful. You think how thankful you are for all your family and, you know, your wife and your kids and your people that have sacrificed for you to get you there. Those are the things that absolutely came into my head. And that's not even cliche. It was those memories and those things of people helping me along the way, they just flooded my mind. Like, holy cow, this was real, but you're lifting it for all of those people, you know, that you win it with.
Oh God, I get emotional just listening. I can feel it in your voice and I can picture it because I was watching that game. And as Minnesotans, you know, we cheer for our own. And I remember you being on that team, Matt Cullen being on that team. And it's got to be a little weird for you right now, Brett, turning on playoff hockey and seeing Carolina and the Rangers, because behind the Ranger bench is Peter Laviolette, your coach that won that cup, and the captain you mentioned, Rod Brind'Amour, on the side of Carolina. What a unique tie to that Stanley Cup championship.
It really is, right? You got Laviolette over there who we win with, and then there's Roddy. It doesn't surprise me. Roddy has had the success he's had as being a coach. He's always been a passionate human being. He, you know what he puts in every day as far as his work ethic. And he's just so consistent, Kevin. No matter what the day is, what the hour of the day it is, you're going to get the same guy every day that punches in. And so that's why that team is so workmanlike, is I think because their leader is exactly that. But neat to see Laviolette having some success too with New York. I think this is going to be one heck of a series. You know, like we mentioned earlier, and like you had said, is just, you know, tough break for Carolina on the first two. But, you know, they're a good hockey team. Now they got to adapt and adjust and see if they can for game three.
I think they'll come back. I'm sure it'll be at least six, if not a seven game classic. Those two teams look so evenly matched. And I just think, you know, you're right. The first round was a little bit of a letdown. All the favorites won, which is so rare in the NHL. But I think now you're going to see more overtime, more angst, and I think you're going to see longer, better series. San Jose had a little bit of a win this week, and it's a noteworthy win. You guys in the draft lottery end up getting the first pick overall, and I think, just from the outside looking in, Macklin Celebrini might be a real difference maker on your roster for years to come. How much do you think that can impact the Sharks, and how nice is it to see the team get that top pick?
Well, it's the first time the San Jose Sharks have ever been able to draft the number one overall, which, you know, for the franchise to be as old as it is, for to have this as its first opportunity is a big one. And so I think it gives the organization and the fan base a little bit of a jolt, Kevin. I think it's been a very hard to watch a team that had so much success for two decades, you know, under Doug Wilson and the Joe Thornton and Patrick Marleau and, you know, the Brent Burns, as you guys all know, with the Wild. I mean, such a great, talented player. But when you put all those guys together, boy, they had a really good hockey team with Joe Pavelski as well. Great to see him doing so well with Dallas again this year. But to have that success, never really get the Stanley Cup and put it in their pocket. They lost that one Stanley Cup that they got there to Pittsburgh. And then the dismantling of the team over the last 4 or 5 years has been tough for this fan base, but this kind of gives them a little bit of hope that they know we've hit rock bottom. They've moved out a lot of the veterans. They've tried to clean up some cap space. And I think now it's about building, led by this Macklin Celebrini and whoever else they're going to add to that over the next couple of years, to try to start to build something that they can really sort of lean into, and the fan base can kind of sink their teeth into as well. As far as some of these players that they can now can believe in, that'll get them to the next level again.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to watch. I think the kid's got a ton of upside. Got to watch him play a little bit in the Frozen Four in St. Paul, and he's a youngster, 17, 18 years old. He's got, I mean, just a ton of growing to do, and he could be a real special player. And I always end up, at some point, because I played goalie, end up really focusing on that position. I don't know how much you do it, you know, and you see, you know, hundreds of games every year broadcasting, and as a fan watching now in the playoffs like I am, Brock Faber plays your position, Minnesota kid. I don't think he's going to end up winning the Calder, but he's certainly in the conversation. When you look at Brock Faber, what do you think's allowed him to have so much success already in his young career?
Wow. You know, I'll tell you, the last couple games that we played against the Wild with the Sharks, the last part of the season when we got you guys a couple times down the stretch, the last, I don't know how many, less than 20 games to go, I think we got you at least twice. And I really had a chance to watch Brock Faber and see what makes him so special. You know who he reminds me of? Not skate-wise, but the way he plays defense is Scott Niedermayer.
Oh, wow.
The way he would defend guys, where you go into the corner, you think the guy's got you, you know, you're going to beat Niedermayer. And next thing you know, Niedermeyer's got the puck from you and he's going the other way and he's making a pass. That's the one guy that pops into my head. Now, again, they don't skate the same as far as Faber and Scott Niedermayer, but I just feel the way they subtly go about their business in their own zone, the way he knows exactly where to be at the exact same time to defend or even to jump in the play. Man, I tell you what, this kid's really fun to watch. I can't wait to see his, you know, progression over these next few years. He's come a long way in just a year. Boy, you look at just how much you guys leaned on him as just a young rookie this season, man. I mean, just sky's the limit for this young kid.
Love hearing your take on Brock. We're all really excited about what he's been able to do in this, you know, his first full season in the league. And, you know, to think that Bill Guerin was able to get him in that trade with LA, where I think the league knew that Minnesota could not afford to pay Kevin Fiala what he needed to get paid. And he's a great player, and somehow worked out a deal where he got Brock Faber and a first round pick from LA. And I think that move, as much as any move they've had here under Bill Guerin's leadership, has been the one move that gives us some real hope that once they get through the Suter and Parisi contract, this team can make a big jump up and be a cup contender. As you know, though, Brett, the Western Conference is just loaded right now. And I looked at Dallas last night. We know what Colorado is. There's just no end in sight in the West.
There really isn't. Well, I mean, the game is so hard. I mean, it's a fast league. And, you know, when you got guys like Nathan MacKinnon and you got Connor McDavid and Draisaitl in Edmonton, and you didn't even think about those two guys, right? I mean, they're right in the West. I mean, and you got to deal with McDavid on a nightly basis playing Edmonton. I mean, I'll tell you right now, that's going to be a very difficult out. They get playing tonight. I'm looking forward to watching to see what Edmonton can do tonight. I think for the Minnesota Wild, that trade with Fiala, I think a lot of people were probably upset early on. They're thinking, hey, we got to keep a guy like Fiala. But when you think back and now you get Faber and a first rounder, that's a phenomenal move for Bill Guerin. I agree with you 100%. And this is something where you guys are building for the next, you know, 3 years. I think if you guys can start to surround Faber and you've got, Kirill Kaprizov up front, and you've got some really great pieces to build around, I think I'd love to see the Wild really make a run here in the next, 3 to 5 years.
It's possible. As long as they've got that 97 on the ice, they have a shot. He's a special player. And I think you can attest to this. Stanley Cups have a way of finding superstars that have a work ethic. And you mentioned some of the guys you played with in Carolina. I just look at the way Kaprizov works every day at practice, every day at the rink, every night, every shift. I feel like at some point he's going to have a chance.
I do too. He's one of my favorite players in the league to watch, right up there with McDavid. Every time you watch him play, the way he works, and if you're a young player that's not very big, just go to the game and watch him. Watch how he positions his body, how he protects the puck, how he can change his motion, of which his speed up and down the ice, how he just turns and pivots just a little bit with one way. Next thing you know, everything opens up. And he just produces offense because of that little, his ability to shift his body. It's been so fun to watch him play and really excited that the Minnesota, not only the fans, but the Minnesota hockey players get a chance to watch this kid on a nightly basis. He's just so fun to watch.
He's spectacular. All right, we've come to the final segment of our conversation. Brett, it's time for the hat trick hot seat. I've got three questions lined up and there's no wrong answer. There's no pressure, but I do kind of want to feel you out for maybe some of these answers and see how much they tie into my experiences. And we'll start with number one on the hot seat, your favorite NHL arena to broadcast a game from. What would it be?
I have to say the Montreal Forum. The Montreal
Bell Center Molson now. Center.
The Bell Center. Yeah, I keep calling it the Molson Center. It's the Bell Center. Sorry. I just, for whatever reason, absolutely love that building. And the perch at which you sit, you go down and it's right over the ice. They got the gondola that kind of comes up and over. Yes. So you're basically looking right over the ice from the top there. I'm not sure it gets better. You know, Madison Square Garden, Kevin, I guess is also one of my favorites. They have now the new gondola that goes over the ice as well. And so you are right over that. So those are the two I'd say Montreal one. And then 1B would be Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, I think for me, it's MSG, but I have a different perspective because I'm always ice level. And that building, it just always feels like a big game. There's something magical about Madison Square Garden for me that I don't care if it's the middle of February and the team's going nowhere and just out there and it's a regular season game. It feels different there. And Montreal, I think to your point, has some of those similar characteristics. The building is always full. The fans are always into the game. It doesn't matter how bad the Canadians are.
They're always full. I couldn't, it's so cool. Both those buildings, Kevin, and thinking back of Madison Square Garden in 94, we had a 25 motorcycle Harley Davidson Escort going, to and from our hotel on games 5 and game 7. And, to walk up that field, that ramp that goes all the way from, the street all the way up into that whatever floor they are in Madison Square Garden. Was it the 7th floor where the ice surface is? Well, anyway, they had that ramp because that was the only way that they could get the elephants up that ramp. It had to be a certain degree for the circus. That's right. And so walking up that ramp, but once you got up that top of there, man, you just felt like there was just something different about that arena. I agree.
That's awesome there. All right. Next one is your very first concert. What was the band and what was the venue of the first concert you ever attended?
Wow. I think that was Billy Joel. My mom brought me to Billy Joel. I loved Billy Joel back in the day. And
no kidding.
Yeah. And it was, I think, at the old Met Center. I want to think it was the
great
Met
spot.
Center. Yeah. So that was, I think, my very first concert. I was a little, you know, I was a young kid, but I think I had Allentown, that album. My mom was like, yeah, I'm taking the concert. And so, yeah. So that was my first concert.
I had never seen Billy Joel until maybe 6 or 7 years ago. We had a day off in New York, and our esteemed producer at the time, it was Fox Sports North, John Stroh, got us tickets to a Billy Joel concert at Madison Square Garden, and I was blown away. I mean, the guy has too many hits, right? He can't play them all. And so at that time, he was asking the crowd at certain points of the concert to pick between two songs, and then we would cheer for whatever song you wanted him to play. And he played for almost 3 hours, and I was just amazed because, you know, this is 5 or 6 years ago. He's not a very young guy at this point.
Oh, he's a heck of a performer. Yeah, I've seen him a few times since as well. I mean, you're right. He's just got the hit after hit. I love this new song that I think he just came out with. I love it. I think it sounds great, and he's still got the pipes that he can still bring it. So good on Billy Joel. But, yeah, first concert, and it's. I don't know if they make guys like him anymore, do they? The songwriters and the people that sound like him, like Elton John and Fleetwood Mac and the Eagles. And think of these bands that we grew up listening to in Minnesota. And I mean, their hits will just be great hits, a century from now.
It's crazy how they've stood the test of time. You're exactly right. And, you know, I think nowadays musicians kind of come and go, Taylor Swift being the exception. But for the most part, guys like Billy Joel and Elton John, I mean, think of the decades their music has been relevant. We're going back to the 70s here, some 50 plus years ago. That's rare in any business to be relevant for 5 decades.
Yeah, crazy, right? When you think about how relevant they've been for as long as they have, but particularly Billy Joel as well.
Final question, we'll let you go, and this has been awesome. If you've got a dinner where it's, whether it's Father's Day or it's your birthday, and your beautiful wife and daughters are going to say, okay, Dad gets to have his favorite meal, and it can be the home-cooked meal, it can be a restaurant meal, but if it's your very favorite meal and it's your special day, what is that meal?
Oh, man. I mean, I got to choose?
I know.
Oh, man. You know what? I think a nice filet, some sweet potatoes, some good vegetables, maybe some broccoli, maybe a little panna cotta for dessert. And some vanilla ice cream. And I think that, and maybe, you know, maybe just have a nice cocktail. I don't even know what that cocktail would be, but maybe at the end of it, sitting there watching the sunset at the end of the night. I think those.
You had me at filet.
I think the sunset would have to be at the end of that meal. It'd have to be part of it. It's actually part of the dessert. It's like an extended dessert down at the dock, watch the sunset.
I love it. Well, it's been an awesome conversation. If I have to put you on the spot, I'm going to do it right here. If you had to pick one team right now to experience what you got to experience back in 2006, so you've watched some of the playoff games, you know these teams as well as anybody out there. If you had to pick just one team right now, who are you picking to win the cup?
Oh, boy, man. You know, I think, thinking about a guy like Joe Pavelski and the career and being an American, and him being a fellow American, him playing as many games as he has and never won a cup, I think he's always done things the right way. And I'd love to see a guy like him that's, you know, winding down his career to raise it. I think that moment of him raising a cup, if Dallas were to win that cup this year, I'd be emotional watching him raise it, because it'd be so proud of him, and to know that a guy like him has, again, done it the right way. It'd be neat to see Dallas win.
Great pick. Well, Brett, thank you again for taking the time. I had an awesome time just learning all these different things and feeling the emotion in your voice. It's just, it's no surprise you're in broadcasting. You have a way of capturing the moment. So thanks again.
Wow. Kevin, thanks so much for having me. And always good seeing you on the road, or, you know, when you're in San Jose. Love seeing you, buddy.
Awesome stuff from Brett Hedekin here. This is Wooden Sticks. We'll be right back to close the show after this quick break. All right, we're back. Kevin Gorg with you here on Wooden Sticks, and I appreciate you hanging with us here today. And, man, hearing from Brett Hedekin, I could have covered more ground and hope to have part two with him down the road, because just the passion he has in his voice. And I think the messaging too. I think if you're out there, maybe you've got kids that play the game, or maybe there are some youngsters that actually have found our show here. Great advice about believing in yourself and putting the work in to fulfill those dreams. It's not easy. You know, as I mentioned on the front end of our show today, it's a long way from Polar Ice Arena to the National Hockey League and onto the Stanley Cup, but it's possible, right? I mean, if you put the work in, if you've got some degree of talent and you're committed to your sport, he had a bunch of up and downs along the way. There were some setbacks and certainly some heartbreak. And I mean, I can't even imagine having that experience. And in 2006, after all that hard work, seeing that come together and that'll live on, you know, forever. That name will be on the Stanley Cup. That run will be talked about. And you felt today listening to Brett Hedekin that you were back there in that locker room with that team, feeling those emotions. And then, you know, seeing them go out there and get the job done and him being on the ice in the closing minute with Edmonton having the extra attacker in a 2-1 hockey game. I mean, that's just, what an amazing experience for him and the connection he had to Herb Brooks and, you know, through the good and the bad of it. And St. Cloud State had a huge impact on keeping his career going. And it didn't sound like it was a slam dunk. It didn't sound like there were like 15 teams beating down his door. He had grown those 7 inches. And there are a lot of late bloomers in the game of hockey. And I think a lot of times people get locked into who a player might be when they're probably a little bit too young. And Brett Hedekin might be a prime example of that, because before he grew those 7 inches and before he made the switch at St. Cloud State to playing defense full time, I mean, who could have predicted the career this guy had? I mean, unbelievable career in the National Hockey League to play as many games as he did, to go to three. I thought it was two, but it was three Stanley Cup finals, and to have his name engraved on Lord Stanley's Cup. I mean, that's just a remarkable story. Olympic hockey. I can tell you this from all my experiences over the years, you won't find a better human being in the game. You know, Brett is always there to take time to have a conversation with you before the game. As you heard today, I mean, really diving in deep to his experiences, sharing those with you. That's who this guy has always been. He's a proud Minnesota hockey guy. And even though he's out in California during the season, I think his heart's still back in Minnesota, spends a lot of his summers here in Brainerd. And I think that came out in our conversation today. So I want to again thank Brett Hedekin for being a part of the show. And I want to thank you for listening. We continue to try to get the best guests for you, and we'll do the same thing. And the timing's usually about the same. We'll record midweek, and by the weekend, we'll have a show ready for you here on Wooden Sticks. And if you want to be a part of the show or know somebody that could use a little boost in their business, make sure to connect with Karen Cleary at TalkNorth.com. It's K-C-L-E-A-R-Y at TalkNorth.com. Put your name on this show. Put your brand out there, and we'll pump it up as we like to do in the hockey world. Same format as always. We'll get that show out here in a couple of days, and we'll look forward to more great guests in the weeks to come. Really appreciate you listening. Talk to you next week right here on Wooden Sticks.